2005, open a public hearing on SB 5522. Dr. Hallett.
Thank you very much, Chairman Devlin and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Leslie Halleck, OHSU. I appreciate the opportunity to come back and finish up our testimony very succinctly this morning. I do appreciate the time constraints you're under. We will not distribute any new material today. We will take up where we left off last time, which was on page 48 or slide 95. Of the material we handed out yesterday. So that's page 48, slide 95, which is what's up on the screen or thereabouts. And we, in fact, will give you sort of a quick summary of the budget request that's before you today. But before I did that, I did want to address one other point in the context of yesterday's discussion that we hadn't yet brought to your attention. As I mentioned in the orientation yesterday, in your packet was a response to a letter from Senator Schrader, and there are a couple of points in there that I just want to make sure are clear for the record. One is really a simple one, and that was discussed in some detail in President Kohler's presentation, but there was one point that I wanted to make sure was very clear. All hospitals do charity care, and in the report from the Office of Health Policy and Research, Bruce Goldberg's team brought together a lot of data from all hospitals that describe charity care, and that refers to a specific thing. It refers to care provided to families of low income, usually defined along the federal poverty line level or some factor multiplier of that level. And you don't charge for that. Those families aren't charged, their credit isn't impacted, and it ultimately is written off for the hospital. There's another category called bad debt. That is, you do charge, and then ultimately you write off because you can't collect. And so when people say that we don't do any more than our share of charity care, they're right. We, like all hospitals, have some of that. Where we incur greater losses than most hospitals is in the Medicaid population. And we lose money on every Medicaid patient, as does every hospital. We just do more of it. So we do twice the state average, almost twice the state average of Medicaid patients. It's a greater factor than that if you compare it to metro health systems. And so when we look at our losses, that's the focus. It's both the charity care and the Medicaid, and the distinction is really in how you use those words, but in the case of the Medicaid patients, that's where we incur our greatest losses, and I just didn't want that to get lost in all the many definitions that are bantered about, and they're all important. The second...
Yes, Representative Jensen.
Could you explain why you do a greater share of the Medicaid than other... hospitals?
You know, it's history. It's our legacy. And we were started, in fact, as an institution, really private and then part of U of O, and then merged with something called the People's Dispensary and Free Clinic. And it was, in fact, a free clinic. And that was joined with OHSU, and this is actually in 1913. And so eventually a county hospital in Multnomah County was located on the hill, on Markham Hill, where OHSU is now located. And that finally became part of the university hospital system. But the historical legacy was, in fact, that OHSU functioned as the county hospital, or in some places it would be the city hospital, as the site where anyone could obtain care. And so we've had that historical legacy. We were, in fact, funded in large part by the state in those days. And so there was a subsidy there, interestingly, not from the county, but from the state. So it's the county maintains an outpatient clinic network, but it has more to do with history than anything else. And it's we embrace that mission because it's a wonderful teaching opportunity in which to train healthcare providers.
Thank you, Rod.
Sure. The other point in the Senator Schrader response is a simple one also from OHSU's perspective, but not so simple in terms of the conversations in the building. And that is that there has been a great deal of misunderstanding about what deals were or were not struck in the public corporation discussions and in the Oregon opportunity discussions. And I just want to state, I certainly don't want to quarrel with anyone, I just want to state for the record that from OHSU's perspective, we never proposed, nor did we think it was the outcome of those legislative discussions, that there was a swap for operating funds. We always thought that was a separate conversation. Obviously, there are others who disagree, but in our mind, there's a sort of operating budget and a public mission that we perform, and there were various either structural changes or investments that were made. And we understand you have to make budget trade-offs, but we, from our point of view, weren't in discussions that struck a deal. So I just wanted to make sure that was clear. We really embrace the task force suggestion from Senator Schrader to have a much more detailed conversation between sessions about what we do and what the state buys and how you measure what we produce in terms of what's contracted with OHSU or granted to OHSU. So we would very much embrace that notion of clarifying all this and hope that that's one of the outcomes. The task force that was suggested at the end of yesterday, I think Chairman Devlin and Senator Gordley clarified, is a different entity altogether. And there we're really talking about a much broader agenda that has to do with sort of societal ways of managing health care. And that's a different issue. They may ultimately intertwine if OHSU's asked to help in that regard, but they're really separate requests.
Dr. Halleck, in terms of, I can see the issue over not wanting the capital dollars to supplant operating dollars. But at the same time, I think it would be reasonably fair to say, since we do this with everyone else, whether community colleges, higher ed, to say that that is part of the support for OHSU.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And so what we've tried to do to acknowledge that is, in addition to, of course, thanking you, is to put that on the graph in a different color so you could see that support. So it is absolutely support for OHSU. It's support for a different thing. It's the research infrastructure and has a good outcome.
We have about five or six more minutes, if you could.
I will.
In the budget detail that's provided, I do not have to go through it item by item. I do want to address a couple of things that I was asked to address very briefly. You have prioritized the programs that remain after the governor's recommended reductions in a slightly different order than we have. This is the order we did, and this is the order that you did. We have no objection to the order, as has been on already mentioned. It was fairly arbitrary what order we put the schools in. This is the order that you address them, and that's fine with us. We, in what was remaining in the budget, had the School of Medicine first because, in fact, 2/3 to 3/4 of the revenue for the institution is generated by the School of Medicine, and they're squeezed very tightly right now. We felt that we were in a precarious position, which is why we listed them in the 60% budget that remained as the first priority. In terms of our add-backs, I went through the priorities yesterday, but in terms of the way we allocated our reductions and requested our restorations, in order to be simple and clear, the situation was so serious that we decided not to confuse things with roll-ups, inflation, any of the adjustments that we normally have to make each year as we budget, but simply to show you where we'd taken the reductions and in an exact corresponding manner where we would request restoration. So those are one-to-one with no adjustments. There's now a page in your notes for each of the six restoration requests. I'll leave those to you. One comment on nursing, and then I'll leave the rest to you. This is how we started the conversation with either raising tuition or closing programs. We rather quickly, through December, moved to eliminating the thought of closing programs. And we did that after conversations with the whole state and the very strong feedback that came from the communities that they would rather see very high tuition than have the programs close altogether. So the second item after the OR is essentially off the table from our point of view. And then I'm going to I will come back to these, but I don't think we have time to go through those in detail unless you ask questions. But there were two other items that Mr. Bender asked me to address. One are the performance measure suggestions. And the performance measures conversation has been going on with higher ed for over a decade. decade. With us, what happened was a little different. In 95, we were asked to come together and create a set of benchmarks, which we did. Actually, that was Mr. Bender's first year with us in his portfolio. We created a set of measures that was presented and approved by the Joint Legislative Audit Committee in 1998. Since that time, we've been reporting to you in the form of a biennial legislative report, this green spiral book that you've all received, a series of measures that describe us. Those are what have been picked up in the agency performance measure list that's been created for you. And the problem with some of those is that they aren't all performance measures. Some of them are just characteristics, like how many patients from each county do you serve. We could set targets and say, let's do more from this county and less from that, but it isn't a very meaningful measure for you of how we're doing. We will work with you on all of these. We have no concerns about the things you'd like to add. We were curious as to why the number of jobs we create wouldn't be a good measure, so I'm not sure why that's being deleted, but that's obviously up to you as to how you want to add and subtract. The one request we have, obviously we'll work on the targets for all these before phase three. The request we have is that this be make up part, if there is an interim group to work on what we do and what the state purchases from OHSU, that the performance measures be part of that discussion so that you know what you're measuring and how it relates to what's being purchased. So that would be my only request that you consider. A couple of slides in here are for the specific requests from the chair on both resident enrollment and graduation rates, and both are in here if you want. I can discuss them in greater detail, but I want to close with two things. I was also asked to mention the policy packages. At this point, I think they're almost moot. They were requests in addition to our regular budget, and what we're focused on right now is the last slide, which is the restoration to the $32.8 million in cuts. This is how we have prioritized the request, and everyone has a slightly different sense of this, but in our prioritization, because of the nursing shortage, which is upon us now, and the momentum that they have in solving the and providing significant solutions to that shortage, that was our first request. AHEC is a bit of a bang for the buck kind of situation. That program underwrites pipeline programs that affect literally thousands of kids, and we think in the long term, the investment in both the rural infrastructure and the health systems, the advice to clinics and hospitals in terms of their staying afloat, and the pipeline development is so important to the state for the investment. The outcome is an extremely positive one. It certainly also helps our schools. It supports their activities in those areas. CDRC is next. Even though the core essence of protecting the three schools and having them in the first place is our highest priority, the reason we prioritize CDRC so highly on this list, from our point of view, is that those families have no place else to turn. That, in fact, if we shut down the programs on the Hill in order to protect the statewide mission, which is exactly how we've structured this budget, those particular kids with those needs really don't have other resources in many cases. In a few cases, they do, but they'll cost more or they'll be less convenient. And so we see that as causing very immediate harm, and we think that's a high priority. Medicine and dentistry are equivalent, and in many ways, to nursing. It has to do with tuition. There's also some core infrastructure and programmatic impact there, and we mentioned psychiatry in our discussions last time for the School of Medicine as an example. And I think yesterday we talked quite a bit about the hospitals and clinics, and I don't need to say more about that. I think at this point my 15 minutes are up, and I should stop and ask if you have any questions.
Senator Nelson.
In this prioritized list, and it actually, I think it also refers to in the response to the co-chair Schrader's letter on page 2 that there's some concern that you guys have been trying to hold the taxpayers hostage by cutting the most popular programs. And then I go back to slide 25 on page 13 of our handouts, the revenue, budgeted revenue and expenses. You've only got 8 categories that you actually budget for revenue and expenses. And, I mean, I think some of our members have the impression that there's a whole bunch more categories out there, and you're just picking these 6 categories to pick. But when I look at this, the only 2 categories you're not talking about are research institutes and sales between units. Is that correct?
That's really correct. That's amazing. An amazing analysis, actually. I don't mean that in any negative way. It's very insightful. The fact is, it really does affect the whole institution and its public mission. So, for example, each of these units has things they do that aren't funded by the state, and those will continue. CDRC is a good example. So, any of the clinics they can sustain, they are. But this really does impact everything except the research institutes in terms of major programs.
Okay, but that's your total of your categories that you're actually of your programs. I mean, I think at least I had for a while I had the impression that, well, maybe you had some other magical categories out there that I didn't know about, and you were just picking on these particular ones. But these are the core of your whole existence.
So. Yeah, thank you.
Thanks, Senator Nelson. I think some of us did not buy into that argument that OHSU was just putting up things to get public reaction. If they had 14 or 15 different things that they could select from, then it would be different.
Thank you very much.
So, anything else? Well, thank you very much, and appreciate you coming an extra day.
So. No problem. Thank you for letting us.
And Mr. Bender does not really get the day off. But
Human lashings coming up here.
It's almost at the okay. This one is mine. This is theirs.
So Linda is going to do the overview.
Here while we start to wrap it up. Okay. Ms. Chamberlain, Ms. Ames. I will go ahead and close the hearing on SB 5522, open a hearing on SB 5529, the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission. And Ms. Ames, I guess we'll have you start off today.
Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, I'm Linda Ames with Department of Administrative Services, and I have a little overview to start out with, it's a paper copy, looks like that. Okay, page 2, you see the complete education program area. On the left, teacher standards has a little bit of other funds, but they still show up as zero because they're so tiny in the big picture. On the right, in the general fund lottery, they literally have zero since they have no general funding. On page 3, they are included in the education principle in the governor's budget. On page 4, one of those dumb graphs, but just emphasize they're all other funds. The majority of their revenue comes from licensing fees. A small part of their revenue also comes from the fingerprint fees. Page 5, like most agencies, the majority of their funding is for personal services, for their staffing. They do the special payments category here is the money they send over to the state police for the fingerprint checks. There's also some money in the services and supplies that goes to the FBI for their part of the background checks. Page 6, you see some history of their funding.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Wisman.
Mrs. Ames, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mrs. Ames, We have some go, all the licensees requests go to both FBI and OSP, and if not, who decides which ones go to which? Right.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wisnett, yeah, all the new licensees, there's checks both places, and they pay their fee for both of those parts.
Yep.
Okay, and then page six, you do see there's a 6.9% increase in their funding over the current biennium. The two major pieces of that are the standard cost drivers for staff, PERS, and health care benefits. And then the other piece is their additional 1.5 positions to deal with some of their workload issues. They also have a fairly small technology package for some new computers and printers. And then finally, page 7, the major budget issues. The governor's budget does include some staffing for workload issues. The budget would continue 1.5 FTE that they have in the current biennium, but they're limited duration positions. So in order to continue them, we need to have them in a package. And then there is an additional 1.5 FTE. Page 8, they do have a fee increase built into the governor's budget, and I just want to make sure there's some confusion on this, and I wanted to kind of try to lay it out right at the beginning. The governor's budget includes a fee increase that is restricted by their statutory caps. While many of the agencies you've been hearing have the ability to raise their fees administratively, this agency actually has caps in statute. They can raise up to the cap but not go beyond it. The caps have not been raised for a while, so they're at the caps in some categories. And what we did in the governor's budget is we came up to the caps in a couple of other categories. Their major revenue producer is their in-state licenses, both for new licenses and renewal. That will increase from $75 to $100. The $100 is at the cap. They also, in this fee increase, need to restructure their licensing. Right now, about half their teachers are on 3-year licenses and half are on 5-year. And this would transition everyone to a 5-year license. So just to put those two points together, under the new $100 fee, a teacher would pay $100 for a 5-year license or $20 per year. This package would provide enough revenue to get them through the 05-07 biennium, but would not provide enough to get them through the 07-09. And part of the reason is because when you move all these 3-year licenses to 5-year, they are not going to renew during the 07-09 biennium. So you have that one biennium of transition where you have to have some ending balance going into the biennium to get you through. This package will not do that. Okay, then as you go down to the second proposal here, what we are requesting is an adjustment to that fee increase that is contingent on increasing the statutory caps in Senate Bill 49, which has been referred down to Ways and Means to allow that to happen. In this case, the licenses would increase up to $110, and there are a couple of other categories that increase, like expediting the licenses. It would also contain the same restructuring, and then that would provide enough revenue to get through the 07-09 biennium. And finally, on the last page, technical adjustments. The January Emergency Board did approve for the state police an increase in the fees for fingerprints. And now we need to provide additional limitation in this budget to pay for that. So because it was effective March 1st, there's actually an issue for the current biennium. They need about $35,000 more limitation to pay for the current biennium. Then in 05-07, they will need $136,000 additional dollars in expenditure limitation. With the appropriate legislation, they would get an equal increase in their revenue because they simply charge for these services from the applicants. And finally, one last little cleanup in the technical adjustments. As a result of the Smart Buy initiative that the state's been doing to get bigger, better contracts with vendors, the prices of computers are a little bit lower than they built into their policy package, so we can reduce that package by $47.92. And with that, are there any questions?
Any questions from the Senate? Representative March.
Thank you. It says about half are our 3-year licenses. What are the other half? And then secondly, if we're concerned about our 0709 issue and the sweep to the additional 2 years for some of these licenses, would have been maybe a 4-year relicensing might have worked better for smoothing out that?
Mr. Chair, Representative March, we didn't discuss that option, maybe because so many were already on the 5-year.
Okay.
And I think Vicki can probably give you more detail on how we happened to have this situation where half of our licensees were 3-year.
Chair Devlin, members of the committee, for the record, Vicki Chamberlain, Executive Director of Teacher Standards and Practices Commission. The commission has used 5-year licenses as a reward in some regards under old licensure for achieving the ability to, by acquiring a master's degree. I'm just going to be direct with you. That was the old system. And if you went to a standard license, is what we called it when teachers acquired a master's degree, then they acquired the 5 years. The teachers who did not, who stayed on a basic license and essentially may or may not have added any additional coursework, were kept on 3-year licenses. And they really do subsidize the system, and it felt like an inequity. The initial new licensure was also set up so that new teachers had 3-year licenses, and then they earned the right for a 5-year. The commission was required to look at our structure over the last biennium, and one of the issues they discussed was moving all the 3-year licenses to 5-year licenses, like the rest of the 5-year licenses, one, so the 3 years aren't subsidizing the system, and two, for parity. So we didn't look at 4 years. We've been pretty much doing 3 and 5 for 30 years. And so.
Thank you.
Chair Devlin, before Ms. Chamberlain starts, sir, if you'd indulge me for a moment, there's an inequity in my mind that I would like for the presentation to keep in mind as it goes through. And in this handout here, in Appendix C, it says, research shows that teacher quality has a definite effect on student achievement. The benchmarks related to student achievement, therefore, are related to the agency's missions and goals. Unfortunately, like most professions, licensed educators are also subject to the influences and quality of their working environment after preparation and licenses. Therefore, the agency can only set high standards for high-quality educators and also for the Oregon-approved programs that prepare these educators. It is up to the school districts to ensure that teachers receive quality professional development, support, guidance, and evaluation to ensure the student achievement. And yet, in the governor's recommended budget, the primary principle is children's education needs are met. Not teacher standards are met. Children's education needs are met. Nowhere in this pamphlet that I saw does it say anything regarding the actual meeting of educational needs of children. This is a little like saying that the TSPC prescribes the treatment, the patient dies, and we blame the districts who administered the treatment. I, for one, won't buy that argument. I think that the TSPC has to also bear the same responsibility as the districts do for the fact that our K-12 education is not performing adequately, and in fact maybe arguably failing up to 50% of our students. Thank you.
Yes, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I have a couple of questions. One I think is rather quick and easy, and that is what is the increase in the fingerprinting? How much? What were we talking? What was it? What is it?
Chair Devlin, Representative Jensen, the state police fee went from $12 per fingerprint card to $28.
12 to 28, a doubling plus of that, okay. The other question I have goes back to the major policy issue. Includes enhancements for the workload issues and the technology. Continue a 1.5 FTE. I need, if you can, a definition of that was a limited duration position, so some explanation of that, and then an addition of a of 1.5 FTE. Fundamentally, as far as the agency is concerned, that looks to me like an increase of 3 FTE. You know, putting it into the permanent hopper, and that seems like a fairly substantial increase in FTE for an agency of this size. And so, could you help me a little about who are these 1.5, and where did they come from, and if they're not continued, where are they going, I suppose? But
okay. Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, the 1.5 FTE that are limited duration did work during this biennium and were approved by last legislative session. And the idea was to have a clear understanding whether there was an ongoing need for the staffing. And I think that the agency has demonstrated that need, and so now we are including them on a permanent basis. This is one of the director's policy packages, so I'm sure she's planning to go into some detail about what each of those positions are and what they do and that sort of stuff.
So the question helps the director a little bit as she goes into that detail then, Mr. Chair, that there's some concern about the addition of the other 1.5 FTE plus the confirmation of or the institutionalization of the limited durations position from before.
Well, at this point, Ms. Chamberlain, why don't we proceed through your presentation. Can you direct the committee to whether they should be looking at this booklet or whether they should be looking at this booklet?
I'm working from this booklet. The skinny one. Chair Devlin, members of the committee, the PowerPoint said an enhancement of the booklet. There shouldn't be anything new here. So you can somewhat read along with me, I suppose, or follow the PowerPoint. So I'd like to just start by saying I know you have seen this and received it, but primary objectives for us putting our budget together and actually for operating the agency are these three bullets at the top on the first page: to improve customer service and to use technology to reduce the impact of increased workloads. Actually, to Representative Jensen's point, to long-term reduce the need for future staff, we're finding that technology is allowing us to shift workload quite a bit. And the third bullet is to ensure adequate funding to carry out the Commission's goals, which may get to Senator Whitsett's concerns. The agency has three statutory duties. Our job is to establish rules for licensure, and the one thing I do want to point out to you, because I'm going to slip in between.
Mr. Chair, if we could just, if you could hold your comments just for a moment. There are two conversations going on over here, and it's just so distracting from what you're trying to present. If we could just wait a moment.
Thank you. Oh, thank you. The TSVC was established in 1965, and it became permanently independent in 1973, and that's when we acquired the statutory duties. And the thing I want to say is that in our statutes, the definition of teacher includes administrator, school counselor, and school psychologist. So I'll frequently slip into teacher. I'll be referring to all educators. I know we tend to think only of teachers. They are the biggest group that we license. Want to point that out. So our primary responsibilities are to license the teachers, and then we also acquired the responsibility to register charter school personnel who are instructing, to maintain professional standards of conduct for ethics, and that's our discipline function, and then to approve the educator programs at universities that prepare our in-state educators, and that's, again, teachers, administrators, school counselors, and school psychologists. I'm going to mention here that we license school nurses. We do not approve school nursing programs. It's just a very unusual function in our agency that the application comes in. If it meets the requirements set by the nursing board, we give them the license, but that's pretty much the extent of our responsibility, so we don't talk about it. The commission's mission is... The TSPC ensures that every student in Oregon is taught by a caring, competent, and ethical educator, and that our vision is to lead the nation in setting and maintaining high standards for teachers. And I think we've demonstrated that Oregon has been a leader in having high standards for our licensed educators. I think this is a point to mention that of all the new licenses that we issue every year, only 40% of our educators are prepared in-state by the 19 institutions that we approve. 60%, and this has been a consistent statistic for the last 3 years, 60% of our new licenses every year are coming in from out-of-state, prepared by other state standards. So moving on, the goals of the commission, there are six of them, and these are what our performance measures eventually are based around, are to maintain and enhance educator professional standards of excellence, and this would be the standards by which we approve programs, to provide leadership which supports the attainment of professional standards of excellence, to provide high-quality services to all stakeholders, and we think we excel on that point by including their input in all the policy decisions. We maintain and develop clear, concise, and easy-to-understand administrative rules. This is an active, ongoing goal. Our rules are being revised and reviewed. They are not the easiest rules to read. We have made progress there. Build awareness of professional conduct requirements for educators, and adopt and implement a cultural competency action plan and standards for educators. This was a goal that was adopted during the 2003 session. I think that I mentioned the history of the commission being established in 65. There are 11 states and the District of Columbia who have independent licensure boards for educators. The rest have offices fundamentally inside their departments of education. So, moving on, what's on here?
Could I have a possible question,
yes,
Mr. Chair? How long has it been that way in Oregon? Has it been that way forever?
We were first established in 1965, and the legislature separated us from the Department of Ed in 1973. And we beat California to being established, but California beat us by 2 years legislatively to be independent. So we're the second longest independent board in the nation.
Okay, thank you.
Here's our program summary. Fundamentally, I've talked about licensure, discipline, and program approval, starting with program approval. This involves doing site visits with the institutions that prepare our educators. We have a compliance cycle of 7 years, which aligns with the national accreditation cycle It's flown the coop. National Council for, it's actually on the next page. Thank you, Keith. National Council for Accreditation. I kept wanting to put college in there, for Accreditation of Teacher Education, which is the largest national accrediting body for educators. We're also looking for alignment with NCATE. What they are have members of organizations like the reading organizations, the math organizations, the English organizations that set national standards, and Oregon's in the process of aligning our content standards with those. Our budgetary issues around program approval have to do with the costs of doing this alignment. It involves meetings with our stakeholders, meetings with educators who work in those areas, and then bringing the new standards forward to the commission for consideration. We are also doing a better job of training our folks who are doing site visits so that their reviews are more critical and incisive, and this has involved a few new costs in terms of providing training workshops and opportunities. In discipline, the...
Representative Winston.
Oh, excuse me.
Senator Gordon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, this is for you and maybe Sue. I thought we had another agency that's come before us that actually certifies that colleges are... There was a... That was in state...
Oregon Student Assistance Commission.
That's only in state schools that they were...
But that's for new programs within colleges in state. And they have much broader...
They don't do any similar type work. There's no overlap or anything, I guess, is my question, Ms. to Sue or to the chair.
I don't believe there's an overlap. But.
Chair Devlin, Representative Wisnant, what the Office of Degree Authorization does is they approve programs before they go to whatever other bodies they would have for approval. So, for example, we did have an out-of-state university come here and request an opportunity to get approval to do licensure in Oregon. It was Lesley University, which is based on the East Coast, and they have a distance education program. They had to receive approval to operate in Oregon through the Office of Degree Authorization first, and then we just looked very narrowly at their education program. The Office of Degree Authorization looks at their whole college and university and their accreditation and those issues. So with a completely different set of standards. Does that help?
Yes, ma'am. Thank you. I guess then, follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
And I guess my next question is 7 years enough? Is that, you know, is that the standard within the field as we're doing them every 7 years?
Chair Devlin, Representative Wisnant, we did have 5 years review cycle up until this past winter, and NCATE went to 7 years, and it just wasn't economically reasonable to ask our universities, you know, to stay on a 5-year cycle when 4 or 5 of them are NCATE approved. So we did it for that reason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Gordon.
Oh, excuse me, if I may embellish. Representative Wisnant, we require annual reports from universities, and anything from the annual report or anything from the college that comes up as an issue could spark an interim site review. They aren't, it's not a, we look at you and then 7 years later we come back and review. We have an annual review through a report and an opportunity to make an interim visit if we're concerned.
Senator Gordon.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and good morning to you.
Good morning.
I have two questions. The first goes to the quality of our teacher education programs on the public side and also on the private side. There are, 13 teacher education programs, preparation programs on the private side, and 6 on the public side. Are you able to tell us which of these institutions, public and private, have the strongest teacher preparation programs?
Chair Devlin, Senator Gordley, I'm not sure that I have any evidence of who the strongest ones are. I tend to believe that the market demonstrates strength, and it doesn't have to do with cost, it has to do with quality. Our biggest provider of teachers is Portland State University, our next biggest there is Western Oregon. And then in the privates, Lewis and Clark and George Fox are the biggest providers of educators. Since I haven't participated in any of them, and only about five of the universities have gone through review cycles since I've had this job in 3 years, it's difficult to know. But I do tend to believe that the enrollment is indicative of the quality of the programs.
If I may follow up.
Yeah.
Is it accurate to expect, however, that the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission would be the agency that the legislature would turn to with the question around performance of these institutions? You are the authority granting program approval. So at some point, the legislature is making investments, if you will, in these educational programs. So how and when will we know? When will there be benchmarks that we can trust that tell us that our investment at Western Oregon or our investment at Lewis and Clark is the best investment to make because we have evidence that tells us that's the case?
Chair Devlin, Senator Gordley, I'm thinking fast as you're speaking about what the quality indicators might be.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the problems we have, I think, might be tracking data after graduation somewhat. I know that we're getting better with tracking our data. My point in that is that it would be possible, I suppose, to measure the employment rates of the graduates with the school districts. That's always not going to be a great indicator because research shows that people tend to stick around where they go to school, and so their employment opportunities are going to be dependent on where the school is located. You could possibly look at retention rates, but at one of the issues that Senator Whitsett raised that we have excellent research on, fascinating research, and I know I brought it up last session, but we have studies here in Oregon that stellar students who have graduated at top performing by the assessment of their institutions, their performance has gone down in 5 years in schools where they were not supported, where they didn't have mentors, where they didn't have a good culture of learning, where the culture of the whole school tended to be negative. By the same token, we had the exact same research showed that mediocre performers' performance improved over that same period with the exact things I said were missing with mentors. So I think that goes to the point of how long do you hold the institution responsible for quality? And I think that was the point we were trying to make in that statement. I think we definitely do hold the institution accountable for quality. And the measures we have are multiple. So I'm not sure how we know they're doing a great job other than to go to the field and ask the administrators who are hiring who, in their opinion, are the best teachers coming out of the institutions.
Follow up?
Yes.
A second question. If you would please address, if not now, at some appropriate point in your presentation, the budget note from last session, which directed your commission to report on the development of a strategy that strengthens certification requirements for teacher licensure in the realm of competency, teaching reading, and demonstration of competency teaching math.
Chair Devlin and Senator Gordley, what we did in the interim is we adopted a new elementary test that was for pre-K through 8, as I recall. We had it aligned with Oregon benchmarks. We had the emphasis put on math and reading in that test. The test was newly launched in February. It's had two administrations well, one coming, actually two administrations, one in February and one in April, we're phasing out our old elementary test. The in-state, I need to tell you that our institutions, because many of them are graduate programs, use these tests as admissions tests. And since reading is a pedagogical exercise and it's something that somebody would not have had training in before they go into education, what we said for Oregon programs is that if they had a reading portion worked into their competencies for graduation of their graduates, then they could take the test for admission purposes that did not include a reading part. And the testing agency worked with us for that. All other graduates must take the reading portion. All out-of-staters must take the reading portion. So the in-staters are getting it enhanced through their program and have to take all the rest of the test, and the out-of-state folks and any graduates or anybody who hadn't already passed the test must pass the reading portion. The heaviest portions of the test are math and reading, and then the other subjects fall underneath significantly.
If I may follow up, this will be my concluding question. The budget note asked for a report to the 2005 Legislative Assembly, again, in this realm, and the focus was on licensure, enhancing, strengthening licensure around teaching reading, teaching math in grades K through 8. Is there a document or a report that captures what you're sharing with us orally that meets the requirements of the budget note?
Chair Devlin, Senator Gordley, not a report per se. I can provide one for you. I missed the report part. We did the action part.
Mm-hmm.
I do want to mention, though, that you cannot achieve full licensure in Oregon without passing the academic tests. So that would be included as part of the report and why that method works.
Okay. Mr. Chair, again, just to follow up, and I'll conclude here, I am going to ask that we be given a report in line with the budget note that documents what has happened around the development of a strategy. That's what was requested. Your oral comments are helpful, but the document will complete the picture.
Chair Devlin, Senator Gordley, I'm happy to do that.
Thank you.
Sorry I didn't do it before.
Thank you.
One thing for the record, and that is that in terms of your, I don't know if the proper word is certification of education programs in various Oregon colleges and universities, your statutory authority is to certify that they meet standards. It is not to rate them in terms of the quality of their institutions. There are outside entities that would do that, I would believe. Is that a fair?
Chair Devlin, that's accurate. Our charge is to set the standards. The pinnacle of quality is represented by NCATE approval in the profession. And we of our 19 institutions right now, only five have NCATE approval with two on board. And the NCATE institutions are Oregon State, Portland State, University of Portland, Lewis and Clark just had a visit, and who am I missing? Western Oregon University. My crib in the audience helps. George Fox is, and University of Pacific is looking. Pacific University is looking at NCATE approval coming up in the next few years.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Chamberlain, looking at your roles in discipline, we're all affected and embarrassed when we have a teacher that gets in trouble. reflects upon us all, and especially this profession. When someone is convicted of a crime, for example, child abuse, do they lose their license immediately? Do you notify other states through this national registry? And would your commission be in favor of taking all of their retirement benefits earned if they are accused?
Chair Devlin and Representative Wisnant, we genuinely stay out of employment issues. We do our best. We're not always successful. That would be, I think, an employment issue with the district, or it would be your issue. I think what we do is appropriate, and that is if they've been convicted of one of the crimes, we are allowed, through your authority, to revoke their license permanently. And unless they're convicted of a crime that you have listed specifically in our statutes, we're only allowed to revoke people's licenses for 1 year. However, you have given us the authority to determine whether or not they're fit to come back and teach, which is a wonderful bar, and sometimes it's very difficult once we revoke a license if they haven't been convicted of a crime for them to come back and prove fitness to the commission to get back into the classroom. I can assure you that if they are a young educator and they have been revoked from permanently from licensure, they're never going to teach again. I don't know what their possibility of getting another public job would be, and their retirement benefits would be fairly insignificant. It would be a long-term educator who would be severely impacted by that proposal, if they found themselves in that situation.
Representative Wisnant, did you?
Just a quick follow-up, Mr. Chair. I appreciate those comments, Director Chamberlain, but I think part of your mission is to set the standards for our educators and establish a standard of ethics practice, and I would hope that the commission would be in favor of taking their money that they earned while they were committing their felony or their act during the taxpayers' money. So thank you.
Representative Jensen, and then I will remind the committee that we are actually doing phase one and phase two for this agency, and they're, I think, through slide about 3 of 20 or 40. Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I will try to help you move along here, though I'm not sure I'll be successful with it, because I'm partially confused. I'm hearing a lot of talk of activity that you have in relationship to reviewing colleges who are in compliance with standards after approval. Are we approving the colleges to begin with? And then I'm also noting in your testimony that only 40% of the new applicants are coming out of Oregon colleges, and therefore I assume you're not don't have jurisdiction to go to the other states to review their colleges, given that percentage, 60-40, and I might ask, why are we getting, and where are the 60% coming from to begin with? But given that percentage, isn't that whole exercise you're talking about in reviewing the Oregon College somewhat meaningless when two-thirds of our teachers are not coming from Oregon?
Chair Devlin, Representative Jensen, I truly do not believe it's meaningless. I think it's very useful to have an accountability measure for our in-state institutions, regardless how many they license. I know in the beginning stages of this agency, and I do not know when it turned over, that we used to produce most of our educators. And somehow with when the economy was great and things have changed and we're becoming more global, this Oregon is changing. We're, as you know, receiving people so quickly. So I'm answering this partly backwards. It appears from our data that our folks are coming from the nearest states, mostly western states, and that we don't have a large influx from back east. California and Washington are our biggest contributors, and vice versa. I think they receive a lot of Oregon educators. All of that said, our checks against those programs we can't review are people must have degrees from accredited institutions. We don't take unaccredited degrees. They must pass Oregon content tests. They must demonstrate they have basic skills. And we have reciprocity agreements for those programs with every other state in the nation. And they have those same standards in terms of having to be accredited. So part of the national registry we use for discipline, we also use for programs.
Don't they have to meet those same conditions coming out of Oregon schools?
Chair Devlin, Representative Jensen, absolutely.
I'm still perplexed at the wise use of your time in, you know, in putting this effort into reviewing Oregon colleges when two-thirds of our teachers are coming from out of state. Well, when the people coming from out of state have to be come from accredited schools. The 19 schools, if that's right, are all accredited schools here in Oregon. They have to meet certain standards as far as testing or what have you. The same as others would have to meet. I guess I'm just kind of confused.
Chair Devlin, Representative Jensen, all of the programs that we accept must go through something similar in their state as well. That's part of the reciprocity agreement. So there is a licensure board in every single state in the nation, and there is a program review function in every state of the nation. And it is those universities and colleges that have been through that same program review that we do here that we accept from out of state. So and they, by the same token, trust our prepared educators who go into their states because we review those programs. So I'm not sure that gets to the core of your concern, but I would be reluctant to quit reviewing education programs based on what I've seen.
Mr. Chair, I have a concern with that, and I'm not going to go because your time is important right now. I'd have concern that in a small agency that we really have the expertise and the personnel to do what we're talking about trying to do and do it meaningfully. And I would have a concern still that that seems a little discriminatory against the Oregon schools. A couple of areas there, but I'll let Representative Mark.
Senator Whitsitt, then Representative Mark.
Thank you, Chair Devlin. Ms. Chamberlain, it appears that the TSPC has made the assumption that your definition of excellent teacher preparation is a standard to accept. This assumption is not accepted universally, even by many educators. So the question is, has the TSPC considered merit-based evaluation of teachers based on student performance outcomes?
Chair Devlin, Senator Whitsett, we are a licensure board which sets the standard for beginning teacher performance, and then we renew their license based on reports from the employers or based on subsequent coursework if they're not employed for renewal. I don't know of a licensure board in the state or the nation that gets involved in performance for renewal of licensure. The law licenses don't do it. The medical licenses don't do it. You have other standards for renewal. That is an employment issue. That is a something that the districts have to take charge of, making sure that the educators that they hire and continue to keep in their classrooms are quality educators. We can't do any more than to watch and set standards for the programs that prepare our educators and set entry-level standards that we think are minimum to ensure that if they're hiring these folks, they should be able to come in and do the job. So, and I think that Oregon has a rigorous licensure process that has done a good job. I've been a teacher in this state, and I feel that I was excellently prepared and that it also prepared me for a future life and other careers. So,
just one quick follow-up. I'm not sure that I that I agree with your analogy. The Board of Medicine, the bar, and the Board of Veterinary Medicine all do in their disciplinary function evaluate the performance of their peers. And I think the TSPC serves both a function of licensing those and then also overseeing their performance.
Senator Devlin and Senator Whitsitt, I agree. And we do discipline, but we don't discipline based on poor student performance. Just like the bar wouldn't discipline me for poor client performance. They would discipline me for violation of ethical standards. And that's what we do, is we discipline educators for violations of ethical standards, and the student performance rests squarely with the school district.
Follow up?
Yeah.
Inadequate professional performance is a reason to be sanctioned in the bar, in the medical profession, in the veterinary profession, in the dental profession, in the nursing profession. Thank you.
Representative March, and then we will get back to the presentation.
And I just wanted to follow up on Representative Jensen's question around this reciprocity and program review. As I understand it, if you didn't do the program review, then Oregon colleges and universities would not be eligible for reciprocity in other states.
Correct.
So it's a trade-off.
Chair Devlin and Representative March, that's correct. And thank you for allowing me to come back, because I was dying to respond to Representative Jensen a little bit more, help you understand the process. We train educators and higher ed in teams who volunteer. They aren't paid other than their lodgings paid by the university to do these visits. We bring them in and we teach them about the standards. We just completed a co-visit with NCATE, the National Council for the Accreditation Teacher Education, have it down this time, and the Oregon State team at Lewis and Clark. That meant that national representatives came in who represented NCATE, who worked along with our state team to evaluate the programs, and they did it jointly. It was done over a period of 3 days. The reports are being written, and by all assessments, the universities, the national teams, and our team, we believe it was a huge success. And it pointed out a few deficiencies that would not have been caught, if you will, or brought to attention but for the visit. So it's an excellent process and works very well and is not very... the costs of the visit are paid for by the universities, not by the agency, other than our staff time.
Mr. Chair? Yes, Senator Gordley.
He said impatiently. well, you know, again, just being frank, this is a hugely interesting public policy area that deserves more time than we're obviously going to give it in the schedule of hearings that we've got to follow. So I just want to say that because it's frustrating that we're not able to really give ourselves the quality of time that we need to give With that said, looking back, I can't recall which session, 99-01, the legislature eliminated teacher tenure.
99.
Can you comment on what has been the result of eliminating teacher tenure? Do you have a way of evaluating what the results have been in our districts around the state? And you don't necessarily need to comment right now, because I know the chair wants to move on. But if you have information, documentation that helps us understand how the policy is being implemented in districts and what we're learning from the implementation of this legislative policy, it would be very helpful. And I think it kind of goes to some of the issues and concerns that are being raised by Senator Whitsitt.
Thank you. One thing on this, and this is in no way in response to your Senate question, Senator Gourley, because I can make a budget tie to your question. One of the things that I think is difficult in this agency is it evokes a lot of questions about education, evokes a lot of questions about education quality, evokes a lot of questions about quality of educators. All of those questions. Those are all good questions. They are all policy questions. They would normally be in Senator Walker's committee if she was here on the policy side. As a Ways and Means Committee, we're charged with seeing that Ms. Chamberlain's agency is carrying out the mission as defined in Oregon Revised Statute and by rule, not necessarily changing any policies in this committee, but seeing if the dollars are being spent wisely. That is a blurred line in this discussion. But it is still there. Ms. Chamberlain can't change any function. If you wanted to do merit-based evaluations later, that might be possible to do, although I think her agency would be much larger if she had to do merit-based evaluations of teachers. But that would be a question of, if you want to change their role, you introduce a bill, it goes through the substantive committee and goes through the legislature, and that's changed. It's not necessarily a budget issue. And sometimes the lines in Ways and Means committees become very blurry between what's a policy issue and what's a budget issue. I am more than willing to actually spend more time on this agency, actually. In fact, I may think that we'll have to, actually, given the time frame that we have. So I think we'll continue on today and part of tomorrow, but I won't schedule them for a work session, and I'll try to bring them back even later. But
very good.
So, I thought you were going to get it done in all one day, Mr. Chamberlain.
Well, it's going to be at least 2 days, but I think it's going to be more like 3 now. But we'll bring them back even later. So, but we have the state library tomorrow also. Please proceed.
Thank you, Chair Devlin. I'm going to pick up, and actually, we've covered many things that are in the future pages. Our budget, our discipline area is one of the smaller FTE areas. We added a full-time half-time investigator last budget cycle, which has allowed us to decrease the turnaround time for discipline cases from 11 months to 7 months, which is significant because educators are waiting to hear from outcomes. And that was a positive move. We are asking for more support in that area. That's one of the positions that Representative Jensen is concerned about. We're actually asking for a new position to support the discipline with the new investigator and other functions in the office. Moving on to licensure, we issue over 18,000 licenses a year. There are over 65,000 different types of licenses out there held by just over 61,000 educators or headcount folks. That's the gives you an idea of the volume of people who are trying to access information in our office, and that's how come we have service issues on our phones and delays in turnaround. But with 18,000 licenses coming through the office, not to mention other requests for services, we only have three people full-time who handle those licenses. The rest of the office either supports another function in assisting them or assisting the discipline function, but three evaluators. And we are successful for more than half of the year in keeping our turnaround time between 2 and 3 weeks on most of those licenses. But in the summertime, when the school districts start hiring, between July and November, we get backed up sometimes as much as 6 weeks. This is still faster than California does it year-round. I learned that it is sometimes 3 months in California to get your license turned around there. So I'm fairly proud of that. But we're working on improving that anyway. We know that if we're able to move the three-year licenses to five-year licenses, it will significantly smooth out that summer workload. So moving on. If you'll look on page 4 of the document, you can see how another part of our service related to licensure is phone calls and email. And with the addition of those limited duration positions, and what we said last budgetary cycle is, if you're reluctant to add positions, would you please approve the limited duration and let us do the documentation to prove that they made a difference? We've made a significant difference. We have rarely over a few days of email gap between responses. It's only when someone is ill or out that we get behind. But we went from an average response time on email or voicemail from 7 days just 2 years ago to 3.5 days, and it's often better. We can go in on a daily basis, and we do this now. We check production. Everyone is aware of it. We have signals when the email get to be over 50 email. There are alerts that go out, and we add staff to get it fixed. And so we're requesting that the limited duration office specialist person that we had in related to that person be made into a 1.0 full-time person. And what I want to say about that is that hundreds of thousands of pieces of paper come into our office annually, and we have started a scanning process that allows us to now electronically use files instead of handing paper around. But it takes quite a bit of work to scan that information into the computers at the front end, and moving that half-time position we have now into full-time will reduce our we have a person coming in half-time now to do the scanning, and we're asking to have that position moved to full-time. We'll also increase the speed with which we can move licensure files through the office. Okay, agency organization is in Appendix A, and I don't know how much time you want me to spend on this. It's pretty much just a schematic of what I've told you. On the first page, we have our deputy director and our coordinator of program approval. It's Mr. Mink sitting back here in the back of the room. He is the one in charge of program approval, but he also handles all the office operations when I'm out and has signature authority in the agency. And if you look on the left hand, that's the executive assistant, my executive assistant, who supports the commission meetings, me and the discipline function. We line her up there. Our office manager is Larry Warren, who's sitting on my left, who does the job of HR, technology, management of the support staff, management of the files, and purchasing and contracting for us. He supervises the movement of materials through the office, and then our coordinator of licensure supervises the evaluations of files and works with districts.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Real fast, Director Chamberlain. Has the composition of the commission changed? And I guess that's probably we established that membership. Is that correct? And then to me, it looks like I'd like to have more members from the public. Has that ever been discussed?
Thank you. Chair Devlin, Representative Wisnant, actually, the composition was changed, and I'm going to try to recall the session was 97 or 99. It was when Norma Paulus was superintendent of public instruction, and it was one of her objectives. There were 9 teachers of the 17 at the time. And so what they did is they took one of the teacher positions and created a new public position on there. That's the only change in composition that I'm aware of in many, many years. And this actually works out excellently since out of the 36,000 employed licensed educators in the public schools, 26,000 of them are teachers, which means the bulk of the issues that come through the office are related to teacher licensure. So the representation isn't disproportionate in that regard. 4 administrators, 1 public higher ed, 1 private higher ed. I know higher ed would like to have a larger voice on our commission. And 2 absolute public members, and then 1 public school board member. They're elected, and they're, you know, obviously not paid. So those 3 people are able to receive a small stipend. But and we have 1 other additional requirement for our commission. At least 1 member has to be a specialist in special ed. So does that answer your question?
Yes,
Chair Chamberlain, just a quick question for Ms. Chamberlain. How many of your employees are being paid for management and or supervisory capacity?
For counting me, that would be my position, 4 or 5. Keith is deputy director. He's paid for management. He supervises a temporary, partially supervises a temporary assistant, but he is in charge of the program approval. My executive assistant supervises, and she's paid for supervisory services. She supervises the discipline function, the PR around discipline, and the staff under there. And then Larry, our office manager, supervises the support staff, and then our coordinator of teacher licensure supervises the evaluation and public service portion of the office.
That would be 5 then?
Yes.
Thank you.
Would you like me to cover the organizational chart anymore?
How many of them are sometimes management versus non-management? Is kind of a... How many of them are represented employees and how many are not?
Chair Devlin, none of the employees are represented in our agency.
Okay, where do we go next?
Where do we go next? I'm going to page 5 and hoping I didn't miss something. If we did, we'll pick it up here, I'm sure. I think that program delivery, I have given you pretty much a really big picture. The coordinator of teacher licensure, as I said, supervises all the files and the phone calls and the email that come through the office. I oversee the entire operation, but I also directly oversee the investigators and the management staff. My assistant keeps track of their time and those other issues, but if there's a HR issue, I deal with that. Final policy decisions in the office are handled at the commission level. We're very careful about that. Program approval basically has 1.2 staff. That's Keith and part of an assistant who is on a limited duration position. I and my assistant support the commission meetings, but the management staff, except for Larry, attends and supports them as well. And Larry, as I mentioned before, wears many, many hats, and he is our direct connect to the Department of Administrative Services, does the technology, does the scanning, does the HR, and does the contracting, payroll, and purchasing for us. So, and if you look on page 6, though, this is the part that I think helps make us successful on a lot of levels, and that is these are our partners, and we do work actively with these folks. Did I miss something?
No.
Oh, okay. Oh, we don't have a slide for this. I'm on page 6.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Chair Devlin, Mr. Chairman, just before we go on to page 6, do you keep track of your travel budget?
Excuse me, I didn't hear you.
Do you tabulate your travel budget as a separate item for your department?
Chair Devlin, we don't keep track of it separately, but we can keep track of it separately. It's primarily in-state, going to school districts or events with educators. We do very little traveling out of state. If you're interested in that figure, I can get it for you.
Please.
For the last biennium. Excuse me, Chair Devlin, Senator, in-state and out-of-state?
Yes, please.
Okay.
Sue, do you want to...
Mr. Chair and Senator Whitsitt, if you look in this binder here, and this may not be the kind of detail you're looking for, but I'll just point you to this information anyway. In the very back, there's budget document, and if you look on page 78, and that number's in the lower right corner of the page, you'll see personal services at the top, and then if you drop down a little bit, it says services and supplies. There's in-state travel, and in the governor's recommended budget, it's $51,858. Out-of-state travel, it's $1,008.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Okay. Chair Devlin, Senator Whitsitt, we can break it down further and associate what's commission travel, what's staff travel, and give you that detail.
That's good enough.
This is good enough?
Yes. That's
okay.
Good. Thank you.
You're welcome. All right. Yay, performance measures. Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Later on in phase two or wherever, Sue, I'd like to discuss the lease, why we're leasing the facility.
Okay. We can do that tomorrow, actually.
I could do it quickly now if you'd like. It's a simple answer.
The question is, I think we should wait.
Okay.
Okay.
All right. With regard to our performance measures, we actually do, we believe, and the Progress Board agreed with us, have three of the benchmarks that relate to our agency, the percent of third graders who achieve established skill levels, and then the percent of eighth graders who achieve established skill levels. This is directly relevant to Senator Gordley's interest in improving our math and reading standards for elementary licensure. And then the percentage of high school graduates who attain a certificate of initial mastery, that's, as you know, a state benchmark. How we believe that's relevant is having teacher licensure programs that train educators to be able to do performance-based evaluations as is expected with a certificate of mastery. So we think our standards are dead on in that regard. We have, I'm going to have to go, actually, I was noticing that we may have unintentionally left out the actual benchmark performance measures, our actual performance measures. But if you'll go to the budget document on page 22 and 23, and I'm in the notebook now. Here's last session was the first session the agency had put together benchmarks, and we were ambitious, and we put together 13 benchmarks, and it wasn't until we became involved in evaluating them and doing our report that we realized how they were inefficient and didn't measure all of our work. But our first benchmark was to get after this program approval issue, as you illustrated so well, is so difficult to get your arms around, and having a standard an average of standards that programs have met. And I'm going to talk here in a minute about how we want to change these. Our second one is the percentage of teachers teaching on a conditional assignment permit, and in plain English that means the number of teachers who are teaching out of field. We keep a record of that if it's beyond two periods a day. Number three would be our involvement with our stakeholders by measuring our numbers of ad hoc committees to do commission policy work. Four, we had a goal to do percent online applications, and we believed that in this interim we were going to be able to get Visa online. That just did not prove so. It didn't work out with DAS. We can't really take applications online without payment online. It creates additional work to try to hook the money up with the application. So that is sort of a pending. Number of public service representatives actually was one we had, and we're proposing to change that to the percentage of phone calls and email that we return in a short period, which is a much more efficient way to measure our productivity than having the number of staff. The percentage of completed applications completed in 2 days if expedited, that is another mark of excellence. If keeping track of that, the districts have teachers have a opportunity to expedite an application at additional costs, and we are required by statute to turn those around quickly. The percentage of complete applications processed in 20 days. We can do this most of the year, as I mentioned earlier. It's an impossibility given our existing staff under all circumstances to do it between July and November. We could get the average out over the year, but the way we are designed and configured right now, that isn't possible. I've learned over three summers now. Percent of higher education institutional ANA reports responded to in 30 days. That's an agency efficiency measure, how quickly we respond to them, that we've measured them and evaluated them and read them. The percentage of investigated cases resolved in 180 days. This has also been a lofty goal, as you'll see that we've only had about a quarter of those resolved in 180 days. That's improving significantly with our half-time investigator. Has made an incredible difference for us. Our percentage of administrative rules reviewed for clarity. This is a great performance measure for TSPCs. Our rules are very cumbersome and they need work, and we are actually making quite a bit of dent on that. We have not been able to do 30% a year, however, and I'm hoping to improve that performance. Providing discipline workshops to educators is improving. I think that's really necessary. It's actually amazing how much educators don't know about the ethical standards, administrators included. And related to that would be newsletters going out related to discipline. We're proposing to delete that. We find that the face visits are much more efficient. And then the percentage of Oregon-prepared candidates who've demonstrated cultural competency skills. Until we get standards adopted and approved and a way to measure that and implement it in a program, that measure is still a goal.
Senator Gordley, then Representative Denton.
Thank you. Ms. Chamberlain, do you also see the need for a performance measure targeted to the requirement in the budget note that we discussed earlier, around the development of a strategy that strengthens the certification requirements for teacher licensure, specifically requiring and implementing a demonstration of competency teaching reading and a demonstration of competency teaching math for licensure of a teacher in grades K through 8. And again, I'm reading from the budget note. Do we need a performance measure that allows us to track progress in that arena. Or would that work be captured someplace else within your performance measures?
Chair Devlin, Senator Gordley, the work is complete in terms of setting the standard of competency by adopting the test. And so I would, in other words, we're saying we're not going to give you an elementary license unless you can pass the new test aligned with the Oregon benchmarks that's weighted toward reading and math. Mm-hmm. And we believe it's going to make a difference. It is making a difference in program adjustments. So it's related to issues you brought up earlier. It's how far out we track something we do here with the long-term implications of what happens in the classroom. I think we may be able to, I think we would know we are being successful if our, in particular, eighth grade math and reading scores improve, which is, as you know, the area where we tend to see a reduction. But I think the benchmark tracking through the Department of Ed is the best indicator of whether or not that's been an effective method.
Okay. Your comment does give me some confidence that we're on the right track. Again, what we're trying to get at is the difference between testing for proficiency, the teacher knows the subject, versus the teacher's ability to actually teach the subject to all children, all learning styles, etc. So if you're assuring me that the performance measures, as you have described them, defined them, have a way of capturing that demonstrated capacity that we're trying to get to, there's an enhancement that we're trying to get to, then I'm willing to move on.
Chair Devlin and Senator Gordley, truthfully, I believe our performance measure on the cultural competency standards is manifesting itself as a requirement that program, we're integrating differentiated instruction into all of our standards for that exact purpose. And we believe that's the goal, to improve the achievement gap. So the language that's going into the competencies, and this would not be separate cultural competencies per se, it would say that educators in math, and we just adopted new math standards and we put new language in here, and I will bring it to you, that says that not only can you teach geometry and the full range of the math skills, but you have the ability to differentiate instruction, your math instruction specifically to persons with native language differences and ethnic differences and cultural differences. Mm-hmm. And we have, I'll bring you the language.
Okay. That's exactly what I'm looking for.
Those are going into our standards that will also become part of what gets measured on program approval.
Excellent. Representative Jensen?
Thank you. Could we go back to your performance measure number one?
Yes.
As you talked about that, you said, I believe, that this is based on no more than two periods out of field per day or per assignment.
Number two.
Talk about the one where teachers teach in field or out of field.
Yeah, I don't know what the heck I'm looking at. My request, I did it. All right. Question is, I'm sorry.
Is that? Would you explain how you judge that, or how you assess that, or what you assess and how you do it?
Thank you, and I apologize for losing track of your question.
That's
we
right.
require school districts and educators to apply for permission to teach out of field. if it's greater than two periods a day or 10 hours a week. And we have a formal method for that, which we have just automated. And what we do, for flexibility for the district's sake, we issue a conditional assignment permit to that teacher to teach out of field so long as within 3 years they acquire the credential to teach.
Okay, so it's based on a teacher.
Correct, and the report from the district.
I'm getting to what's bothering me on this. I'm a principal or superintendent or something in an average somewhere Oregon high school, and it would be on the basis of this way this is stated and the way you're measuring it, possible for me to staff my entire math courses offerings with people that were out of field.
Chair Gordley and Senator Jensen, yes, it would be possible.
And that would be something that would greatly concern me if we were...
Chair Gordley and Representative Jensen, it should concern you. The it's temporary. It's not permanent. They have to acquire the credential. But we also now have No Child Left Behind and the high-quality teacher requirements, which are... a significant amount of public pressure on districts to not be doing that.
Yes, and I do appreciate that, but the nature of the way this is being, and I'm not quarreling that this is an important variable and something you should be looking at, but the nature of the way we're collecting the data leaves some possibilities that none of us would like to have. The other thing, of course, the other issue that concerns me, that as a teacher or as a student, one-third approximately, since most, I probably six or seven periods a day as the probably average school, high school, one-third of what I do or one-third of the classes that I take are somehow or another not defined as being important enough to have a qualified... I think, Madam Chair, that the use of two periods per day, I'd be much more comfortable with this, even though our percentages wouldn't look as good, if we were honest and said any.
Chair Gordley, Representative Jensen, that would be a significant staff increase issue. The districts, this has been a commission rule for 30 years.
Well,
it is used primarily in the rural districts.
I understand.
And.
And I realize I'm beating up on my districts by making these accusations, but it's still an area of concern, and in part it makes us look good. It gives us the ability to look good when we may not be good.
Chair Gordley, Representative Jensen, the ultimate indicator obviously would be student success and performance, right? And the last place we have to check that's the 10th grade. Frankly, given the school report cards and the data reporting we have to do these days, districts aren't willing to risk those type of staff assignments unless they absolutely have to. When I was teaching and I was misassigned, I was 6 hours short of the coursework required to get the endorsement. In other words, I wasn't significantly underqualified to teach the subject, and I think a lot of folks are in that situation. I don't disagree with you about possibly for true accountability tracking all teaching out of field. It would require us to do a business analysis of the cost to do that, but and if the legislature was interested as a policy issue, it would almost be necessary for you to require us to do this, because I may have a revolt to just do it on a policy administrative rule basis after 30 years of allowing this practice.
I truly appreciate the benefit history.
I also appreciate that times have changed. And what we did 30 years ago may be inadequate today. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative March, did you have a question or comment?
It's totally on a different subject, Madam Chair. You want to take it up later?
That's quite all right.
Okay. And this is for DAS or LFO. In the revenue categories, there is a line for interest income, and I note there is none, which goes back to our other health license. It has nothing to do with TSPC, so it goes back to a discussion we had about the health licensing boards, and their DAS is providing proposing to provide interest earnings on the reserves, and here we're not. So we need to work on that policy decision of keeping those interest earnings for other purposes or letting them float. So it's just an observation. Mm-hmm. Let us be consistent.
Please continue.
Thank you. Chair Gordley and members of the committee, I think in the yellow notebook, I need your approval to approve the changes we're requesting to our performance measures. And that's what I just like to run through here with you. Our review by the Progress Board indicated that they thought that 13 performance measures for an agency our size was way too many, and I couldn't agree with them more. So on page 19 in the yellow notebook would be our request to modify our performance measures for the next biennium. And we are requesting to delete the average percent of program standards met by each institution. These were difficult to quantify. For example, there were nearly 800 standards in the Lewis and Clark visit, and there were three unmet out of the 800, and it's just, it doesn't prove very much, frankly. We'll seek another one. The next measure, which was our performance measure number 4 that we're seeking to delete, is the percentage of total applications renewed through the web. Until we acquire the electronic capability, that's going to be something we're going to have to continue to report a zero on. It's been dependent on DAS's ability to allow us to do the visa services, and we just started taking visa over the counter, but we haven't perfected the electronic online process. Our next request, our third one, is to modify our fifth performance measure. And instead of saying that we're going to measure our performance based on the number of positions who are answering phone call and email, that we will base our performance on the percentage of phone calls and email that we return within 3 days, which is a very reasonable turnaround time. And we can, and we keep track of that daily. It's easy for us to measure on a databasis. Our next request is to delete performance measure 7, which was the percentage of completed applications processed in 20 days. As I indicated to you, for nearly 6 months of the year, this is an impossible goal. We do believe it will improve if we smooth out the number of licenses coming through from 3 to 5 years. And we have also perfected, and actually this does get along a little bit with Representative Jensen's issues around program approval. Since we approve the programs and we monitor them annually, we were going through an extremely protracted process to approve those licenses. And we've created a fast track for Oregon institutions, for graduates who graduate from our approved programs. We're not having them submit all the documentation. We have set up an audit process with the universities, and we are issuing those licenses in less than 7 days. And that has made a significant difference. And it was a vast improvement on service. We don't know what effect that's going to have long term over all the licensure turnaround, because we still do renewals and new applications. Our next request is the is to delete the percent of higher education institutional annual reports responded to in 60 days. It's not a good quality measure. We actually were able to get it done quite easily, and all it proved is that the staff got on it. And then the next one we're proposing to delete performance measure 12, the number of newsletters. We're looking at possibly developing an ethics test, which would be more valuable than a newsletter, because something, we either have to incorporate, we just newly incorporated ethics as a standard that has to be incorporated into the administrator preparation program. It's never been overtly incorporated, and we're seeing this has to be discussed more with educators. And then finally, our cultural competency skills, we need to add that. We adopted it, the goal, but the standard has not been formally added to our standards. And until we can develop the measures, we won't have a way to measure it, but it is not formally part of our performance measures.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I would just like to take this opportunity to commend Director Chamberlain and the commission for its work around developing the standard that will be used in the area of cultural competency for educators, administrators. It's not an overstatement to say that Oregon is taking the lead in the nation in this arena of moving toward cultural competency in education. And I'm very proud of the work that you're doing and of the commitment behind that work. And I would also add the integrity that you bring to the work. So just want to encourage you to keep on keeping on, and know that your work has meaning for the children, the students in the classrooms who are waiting for teachers who are more competent to meet their needs. And I thank you.
Chair Devlin, Senator Gordley, thank you very much. I think you'll be very pleased to know that the commission has embraced this, and they keep an eagle eye out for whether or not we are careful about making sure we're differentiating instruction and reaching every child. It's been a very exciting 2 years. All right, where are we? Are we all right, can I have a time?
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
It would seem appropriate in light of the good senator's comments about complimenting the agency for the work they're doing on cultural competency that I recognize Senator Gordley and that a lot of the good work that's being done around the state on this is compliments of Senator Gordley keeping a very diligent eye on and tenaciously hanging on to this issue. I think we're very fortunate to have her in our midst and to be doing this job, taking up this issue.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. Thank you.
Why don't you conclude in about 1 minute, and we'll bring you back tomorrow at approximately 9:30. We're going to be in the state library the first thing tomorrow morning.
We're going to be in the library? Oh,
no.
They'll be here. Okay.
That was literal. Careful, slip of the tongue.
Okay. Some of us
want to
go here.
Tomorrow we'll talk about our budget drivers, our specific packages, and our fee proposal, which is a little bit complex. And we are prepared to give you a cash flow analysis. We'll also discuss the legislation that may affect us, and I think that would wrap up our presentation.
Any final questions? Okay. I will carry over the public hearing for 5529 for hearing and possible work session tomorrow. And I will close this meeting, and we will start at 8:30 tomorrow morning with this, not in the state library, but with the state library. I'll see you all tomorrow morning.